can't go back to jail!
Good evening, or good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am your host, Philip, the Mile High Mouth, Wesley, and you are listening to Radio DMG on this Friday, the 28th, of June, 2013. So, let's get down to business. What are we doing in this episode today? Well, we're going to have an extended bit of, our Sana coverage. We've got the Funimation keynote from Sana. That was a summit on anime in North America. And then we might have a musical ration. And that's it. That's what we're doing for this episode. Excuse me. I know it's been a while since our last Radio DMG. There's been so much stuff that's happened between then. We had Denver Comic Con. And we had E3. And we covered a bunch of that on the website. And there's not really too much more to say about those. Just go read the press releases we put out. There's some, our sweet release press releases. We have hyperbole notes. We make corrections. Sometimes we'll fix grammar. Check out our hyperbole notes on those. Those are pretty interesting. We try and make those as interesting as possible, even though that is really just white paper. We were distracted a little bit. We had the 1 year anniversary of Animation is Art, and, that's good. So, the tricky part about that now is getting funding, because lots of other stuff is just... Sometimes life tends to completely crap all over you. You know? But we're working on it. You know how it is. So anyways, what are we doing? We're going to have the Summit on Anime in North America bit with Funimation. A musical ration, and a audio review from the Animation is Art podcast. The Animation is Art audio experience podcast. We're going to do an audio review of Monsters University, which is why we had that clip. So yeah, that's what we're doing today. So just sit back, relax, put your headphones on, and rock out to our sweet dulcetone goodness. I'm your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth. You're listening to Radio DMG. Now we're going to cue our feature presentation right now.
Sure, I still have a fourth generation ROM. I won't have raw cassettes somewhere in my house. But do you really want to blow their minds? A friend of mine has 3 of the 4 Macross Plus laser discs. You really want to blow their mind? Pull out a laser disc and watch them just go, "What's that?" It's a shield. No, that's... Anywho, it's vinyl, exactly. It's really, really vinyl. All right, you heard her talk a little bit more, and so we're going to bring her up again because she's oh so cute, and a man who absolutely personifies the fact that bow ties are cool. Ladies and gentlemen, Sarah Sullivan and Christopher Bevins, welcome up to the stage.
Now I got to do more tech stuff.
let Sarah run point on this mostly because she's used to talking to groups of people. I'm used to talking to a person in a box. One at a time.
So, and I'm actually, I have a really, really hard time staying still. There's not really too much of a presentation. I just wanted to throw up our little logo. As most of you guys know, Funimation has gone through kind of many incarnations, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But I just wanted to say that I am Sarah Sullivan. I am Convention and Events Manager for Funimation Entertainment. Actually, now it's just Funimation. We took off the entertainment, even though it's still entertaining. But I have been with the company for about 3 years. I started in the production department as a production assistant to Miss Clarine Harp, who is our DVD and Blu-ray guru, and some of you guys also know her as the voice of China in Italia. I was very, very fortunate to be able to come into Funimation after working in an advertising agency environment for several years that made me want to stab out my eyes. When the job came up at Funimation, I said, you know what? There's no way I'm going to hate that. So that was why I decided to go to work in the anime industry. I personally have been an anime fan since I was about 6 years old when my babysitter brought over Ranma One-Half. In addition to that, my mother grew up in Hawaii and was a big Speed Racer fan when she was younger. So she had a little bit more exposure to Japanese culture than a lot of other people's parents do. So she brought that into the house at a very, very young age. So I was able to get exposure to a lot of very, very different and stylistically unique things when I was younger due to the Hawaiian heritage involved. But I'll get into some of that stuff a little bit more, but I'm going to let Mr. Bevins introduce himself as well.
I'm Christopher Bevins. I am a voice director primarily for Funimation. I also do a bit of voice acting, act as a line producer for the shows I work on, and have done a whole bunch of script adaptation as well. I started out as an ADR engineer, recording engineer, so I've pretty much done every job there is on the dub production side of things. I've been directing for 10 years and have done virtually every type of show out there, whether it be teen panty comedy like Heaven's Lost Property or sweeping epic samurai things like Samurai 7 or Sengoku Basara. But what really, really, really grabs me, and we'll talk about this more too, and in fact, Dr. Friedman mentioned it very briefly, strong female characters. I love directing shows with strong female characters because there's almost none of that in traditional American media, especially the kind that you see in anime. Things like First Angel, Speed Grapher, Witchblade, a lot of the shows I've worked on, and the most recent one, which super special place in my heart now, and in fact, this is only public if you read the bio on the Santa website, but my just finished work on Michiko and Hachin, just the most amazing show with amazing, amazing characters. So, so that's what kind of what floats my boat and, you know, turns me on when I'm directing, and look forward to sharing some of my experiences working in the industry to help, you know, answer these questions.
So I do want to start by talking about a little bit about Funimation as a company, but I do want to preface very, very quickly, for the sake of posterity and also legal reasons, is that some of the views expressed by Mr. Bevins and myself may not necessarily be the views that are espoused by Funimation as a corporation. So please do not take this verbatim as being the opinion of the company in any way, shape, or form. I have to do that.
I'm kind of opinionated.
We have no opinions whatsoever. So I want to talk a little bit about the foundation of Funimation and the role that it has played within the anime community within the United States. Funimation as a company was actually founded in 1994 by Gen Fukunaga, who is still our fearless leader. It wasn't until 1998 that we actually saw Dragon Ball Z come out on Adult Swim. However, prior to that, they spent several years in the process of doing the dub, casting, et cetera, so on. It took a lot longer back in the day as well. But that was also one of the things that helped to pioneer our relationship with Toei Animation, which remains very strong to this day. Two of our biggest titles are still Dragon Ball Z and also One Piece. So we're very, very fortunate to have such a wonderful relationship with a excellent company that does wonderful work. We originally started off in the heart of Texas, in the Fort Worth area, so which is kind of an unusual place, a lot of people think, for an anime company to blossom, but that was where Mr. Fukunaga was located, and his original partner, Gary Kokenhauer, who helped to finance the bringing of Dragon Ball Z to the United States. Since our company was established in 1994, we are very, very lucky that we will be celebrating our 20th anniversary next year. We're very fortunate that we've been able to survive the various tides and also the various financial shortfalls of our country as well. One of the things that, that Funimation has always prided itself on is the fact that we have always made sure that we release very, very high quality product, very high quality dub, and that our video quality is almost second to none within the industry, especially back in the earlier days where we were taking things directly off of film in a lot of cases. So we were able to, after we did, after the job that we had done with Dragon Ball Z, we were able to get other kind of standout titles, like, for example, Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood, to bring a lot of really interesting and compelling content to the U.S. anime market. In addition to that, as many of you guys know, when several of our counterparts within the anime community in the United States went out of business, we decided that something that was going to be important not only to the fandom but also to our company was to ensure that a lot of those excellent, compelling heritage titles continued to be available to the market at large. One of the reasons why, for example, we were able to obtain the license for Last Exile, then Last Exile Fam the Silver Wing, shows like Akira that we got the license for last year, shows wonderful Genion titles like Ergo Proxy, Hibernate, Serial Experiments Lane, which we recently released on Blu-ray for the first time ever. Sorry, I still have to sell things. I can't help it. So making sure that we look backwards while we also look forwards has always been something that's been very, very important to Funimation. There's such a wonderful and amazing rich history of anime in the United States and some of these shows that have been so important to some of us. You know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, there were a lot of really, really unique programs that you hadn't really seen something like that before that had come out, especially from companies like Genion. So we were very excited to be able to add those to our company. Myself, as a as an employee of Funimation, especially now in the position that I'm in, one thing that I can say wholeheartedly with no irony whatsoever in this is the fact that I love our fans. I love our fandom. I love all, I call you guys my kids. And I love being able to go out to shows and to be able to talk about how much I love anime with all of the kids that come out to see us. And I think that one of the things that's going to help the anime industry the most, especially in the United States, is the continuing education of the fans. For example, as I had mentioned earlier, where you have a lot of people that are just like, well, it came out in Japan, why can't I get it now? And especially with Crunchyroll, with some of the things that Crunchyroll is doing that are very innovative, Crunchyroll is actually really pioneering the use of new technology in anime distribution in the United States, which I think is very, very important. It was also the path that they chose to move towards legitimacy and that kind of thing was also extremely important to the industry as well. And that's one of the things that I really like to stress, especially I do a panel called Funimation Town Hall where we talk about the current state of anime and what we see the future being. And download to own digital content and that kind of thing is going to become a huge part of any good anime company's model going forward. Because it's as I had mentioned, millennials are changing the way that we consume media. They're changing the way that we consume the arts as well. So digital artistic work is exploding within the U.S. right now. Even just in the Dallas area, we have Southern Methodist University has a new MBA program called the Guild Hall that is geared specifically towards entertainment and gaming for a master's in business. So obviously, those kind of things are something that companies like us that have managed to maintain financial stability really need to keep into account so that we can continue to bring this kind of content to the fans. So I'm going to move on just a little bit from there and talk a little bit more about kind of what we see as the future of anime. And so I'm going to pass this over to Chris and let him talk about that for a little bit.
What I think the future of anime is? Wow. Because that's tricky. It's changing all the time. It's definitely, yeah, every day, every year, it becomes more, there's more connection with the fans. You know, Facebook, Twitter, the more that the companies and the voice actors, production people, what have you, interact with the fans, and not just at conventions, but on a daily basis, you know, talking about what you had for lunch today online. It helps bring that fandom in even closer. It makes them feel more a part of that community. And to me, the future of anime is all about the community that backs it. Whether it's backing it financially or just as a fan, and you know, with awesome costumes and with creative other creative outlets. But I think really that we've seen so much really interesting storytelling, especially in the past few years. That, like, from about 2000 to 2003 on, the kinds of stories that are allowed to be told in anime, that especially the ones that have been licensed to for the United States, there's so much wealth and opportunity of content that as more people discover what this anime thing is, everyone finds something that they love. There's something for everyone. So I think it's going to become even more mainstream and less of every niche pop culture thing kind of is going through a mainstreaming of sorts, whether it be comic books, American comic books, you know, thanks to the superhero movie boom, things of that nature, you know, it because of the ease of access to it. So
another aspect within that that I like to talk about a lot is kind of a little theory that I've developed myself that's, I call it owning your freak, is that in the day and age that we live in now, we are more encouraged to embrace what makes us different. So it's not so much the lifestyle of the solitary otaku that you used to talk about, where you know you didn't have a lot of people in your area that necessarily consumed the same kind of media that you do or have the same kind of interests as you. Now you would be hard pressed to find any library in a major metropolitan area that does not have an anime club. There's been an explosion within it, and I think that another thing that I'd like to expand upon a little bit that was mentioned earlier is the exploration that's allowed by anime. One of the things that, like I'd said in that Anime 101 for Parents class that I've done, is to let them know that in a lot of cases, it is a very safe and controlled way for children to explore their sexuality. With questions that you might not necessarily be comfortable asking your parents, but you have the opportunity to see them in a certain situation and to be able to think about that, to be able to process that in a way that's a lot safer because it's not live action, because it is animated. And it's one of the things that I like to talk about as well. I'm involved in the Big Brothers Big Sisters program. My little sister had two big sisters prior to me that didn't want her because she was weird, because she's an anime fan. And so when I came into the program and they were just like, you're perfect. So, and it's one of those things where there is still that certain amount of stigma that exists specifically pertaining to anime, because they just assume that we're all cosplayers, that's how we're dressing at home. And I'm not even kidding. These are seriously things that I have had people ask me about when they find out that I work in anime. They're just like, oh, do you wear kimono at home? Do you only eat Japanese food? And that, and I'm like, it's different. It's different, you know? I mean, that's like, and one of the things that I think has been both a supporter and a detractor to this has been the My Little Pony and Adventure Time. It's bringing cartoons that have more mature themes, even though they may be subtle, and they might be the subtext of the show. It's really kind of helping to increase the acceptance of anime for a more mature audience as well. So, which, you know, people say, you're over 18 years old, give up the cartoons. It's like, but that's not the way that it works. It's a huge part of my psyche and my lifestyle, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to go into anime as a profession as well. But one of the things that I think that's most important about the fandom as well is the culture of inclusiveness that has been established and supported by the anime fandom. It's the fact that most anime conventions, you're going to be able to go there. It's going to be you're going to be reasonably safe. You're going to be surrounded by people that love the same things that you love, that are interested in the same things that you are interested in. And I think that for especially a lot of these kids that we're talking about, that in some cases are on the fringes of the groups in their schools, that it's so important to be able to have that. And a lot of what I speak about comes strictly from a convention perspective, because I spend so much time at them, and I staffed conventions in Texas, and they're very near and dear to my heart as a place where people can go to be themselves.
Yeah, that's definitely, and that's been my experience in getting to interact with fans just from what I've done. And that's what draws me to it as well. It's what drew me to reading American comics, with which I'm an enormous fan. It's that feeling that when you find your group, that you all share, yeah, the secret language, that you all know what the sweat beat means and what the little pound symbol, the angry pound symbol means, you know, and everyone knows what these little things mean, and if you don't, then you want to find out, and the community will be happy to help educate you without turning their nose up at you, and that is, to me, what has helped foster all niche media, whether it be anime or comics or skiing movies. Who knows? The extreme sports movies. It's all the same thing. Everybody's got their the thing that they're really passionate about, but that not everybody really understands. And it's almost, you almost want to call it the gang mentality. It's like back. I remember when I was in high school, all that was on the news was the Crips and the Bloods and the gang problem that was going on. And it was because there were these people who didn't have another creative outlet, but they wanted to be part of something. They had to be part of something, and that was the outlet for them. I'm so glad that kids today are dressing up, in blue hair and giant wooden swords instead of going around shooting each other.
In addition to the fact that there is also one of the other themes that you see in a lot of anime and manga is these merry bands of misfits that very, in some cases, grudgingly become a family together. And I think that that's something that definitely speaks to anime fans as a whole, because most of us, it's like I tell people, at Funimation, by and large, we're all fans. And it's like I tell my family, when I started working for this company, I found my tribe. And I think that that's something that anime does for a lot of people, is that they may not have, they've got their couple of kids at the school that they're able to bond with, but when they go to a convention, I know people that have people that they consider some of their best friends that they see twice a year at con. And it's, I look forward to going to con because I get to see all of the convention staff that I absolutely adore. I get to see the fans that I see at the same shows over and over and over again that are wanting to come and talk to me about new shows and cool new stuff that's going on. And then I just want to find out, how's your mom? How's school going for you? Last time I talked to you, you changed your major. I mean, that kind of thing. And we invest so much into the fandom and into the shows that we love, and by proxy we wind up investing in each other, which I think is something that is so important about the community. In the past, when things have happened if there's been the one person that kind of goes off the deep end and they say video games caused that, or they watched violent cartoons like Japanese anime and that kind of thing, and I always think in my head, I wish they'd gone to a convention. I wish that they had met the community. I wish that they hadn't been the solitary otaku that didn't know who they could turn to. So I think that that's one of the other things that's so important about this, and so important about anime as a culture within the United States, is that we need to embrace each other. And that's going to be something that not only in the case of companies like mine, but also in the case of conventions and in the case of the genre in general, that's going to continue our success within the North American market. So I do this a lot, but yeah, I mean, so let me go ahead and just open up the floor and see if anybody has any, if there's any questions that anybody has. This is weird because I know that I'm not going to have like the first three people ask me how to get into voice acting. So I'm really kind of looking forward to that. So, and that's, speaking of voice actors, is that, oh my God, okay. Are you going to license Sailor Moon? One of the other things that I think is has been unique, especially within the industry, is in the last 10 years particularly, is how the voice actors have just become rock stars in their own rights. Part of that is because more and more we are looking specifically for actors, for people that are trained, for people that are able to emote in a way that they never were before. And this is something that Chris can speak to a little bit more on. This is, you know, the quality of the product that's available now. And for a lot of people, especially within the anime fandom, we tend to have a lot of people that have learning disabilities and that kind of thing. So not having to read subtitles and being able to hear and see the show and to be able to consume it that way, I think helps people to more fully immerse themselves into the world. Because they're not having to process the written word on the screen in addition to everything that's going on. They're able to just sit back and have it wash over them, which I think is so important, especially for how much more popular anime has become, and especially with the what I like to call the passive anime fans, the fans that you see come up that are maybe into video games and that kind of thing, and so they've been exposed to the style, but they may not necessarily have been exposed to the richness and the depth of the storytelling that you find in a lot of anime series. So those are the people I think that are really going to that have become kind of the future of anime, because especially with the fact that we've got that, because of a lot of people here in the audience, we were able to get Toonami back on the air, which has been so important to be able to expose the general public to anime. And that just by having something like that available on in a broadcast situation makes all the difference in the world. It really, really does. Because you can say, okay, you want to know what I like? Well, I know you're not going to be asleep at 1 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, so go watch Soul Eater. Trust me, you'll like it. So, and it gives you the ability to do that without, you know, just change the channel to Cartoon Network. See what it's all about.
That leads me to something, we're, you know, when Jerry started Streamline, you know, there was probably not a lot of money in anime yet, and you were, you know, the kind of product you were able to do with the kind of money you were able to put into it was only so much, but because of the awesome hard work that people like him did, I got to see it. And I got to learn more about. In fact, some of my earliest exposure to anime was working at a comic book store where we were the only comic shop in all of New Mexico, in Albuquerque, to sell and rent anime in both dubbed and subbed versions. And that's, you know, because of that, though, all of these people who watched it were now in that second generation of the people who said, wow, I'm a fan of this, I want to make this. And because we have that intrinsic built-in love already of the characters, and now there's more money to put behind it. We can get, you know, trained actors, whereas in even the early days of Funimation, it was whoever answered the ad in the newspaper, you know. It was whoever we ran into on the street that had a really cool-sounding voice. I think now, though, because it's a snowball effect. Every generation, you know, they call it the fan fiction generation, you know, which is that those of us who grew up loving it are now making it. And I think there's a great deal to be said for that passion turning into a great product. And I don't care if you don't watch the dubs. push the button, watch the sub, I don't care. The dub sub war ended when DVDs came out on the same, you know, they're on the same disc. I do want to provide an option, though, for people who, in my opinion, I feel that my job, I'm not doing it unless I'm hopefully giving my audience the same emotional response that the Japanese audience had. You know, the sub can tell you what the joke is. My dub better make you laugh.
So, and seriously, at any time you have a question or a comment or anything like that, either come up to the microphone, throw your hand in the air, so we're more than happy to go. Yes?
Since you're making the Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z, I have both videos in English and Japanese, and I have a specific scene compared, and I was so surprised that the Japanese Dragon Ball Z, the voice actor of the Goku, is Naoko Nozawa. Her voice is really feminine, and there's one scene that she was talking to her son, like, it's okay, I'm going to save the world or something. And the same scene, exactly the same scene in English, the voice actor's voice is really manly, like superhero.
That's more along the lines of the decision that the director makes. Because in the case of Dragon Ball Z, that was directed by Christopher R. Sabat, who, as I said, is like probably one of the most well-known anime voice actors. But that's also because of his work in anime. He has been able to expand into many other genres as well. His company, Okatron 5000, recently did Borderlands 2. I mean, they do a lot of really, really big stuff. But that's a decision that's generally made, and I think that part of that was the fact that... And I'm speculating. I'm completely speculating. Was that we knew that this was a show that was primarily going to be consumed by men between the ages of, well, males between the ages of probably between 8 to 18. And so they were probably trying to harden the edge on it just a little bit. So I'm going to let Chris talk about
it. That specific reason, there's a couple reasons. In Japan, Dragon Ball came first. In America, Dragon Ball Z came first. So with Dragon Ball, it was the same voice actors portraying Goku all the way through because there was that purity, the purity of the character, and that was intended to be, and that's why the same actor portrayed Goku throughout the series was to help convey that constant purity of youthful purity of Goku. Whereas in America, what our first exposure to it was Dragon Ball Z, which was the more action side of things, and it was the superhero side of things. And it just speaks to the kinds of... there are different tropes, there are different expectations that Japanese audiences have for certain types of voices versus what American audiences expect. When they see a character, they expect it to sound a certain way. And those expectations are different across the cultural borders. And that's always the trick with what we do, is finding that balance of what is going to compel, what is going to grab my audience, but what also is not going to be a slap in the face to what came before.
My first actual memory of anime is a VHS call. It was the Fire Prince and or the Water Prince and the Fire Child.
Sea Prince and the Fire Child.
I don't even know how old I was when I saw that, but it was really early. I'm born in the 70s, by the way. the way things have changed, you know, the history of anime, the way it's been adapted and I guess formed into our culture, and the future of how it's going to continue to be consumed. I'm actually really excited that you said Michiko Tohachin is going to be, you know, released. I'm definitely gonna have to pick that one up.
Thank you. We hope there are a lot more of you.
That was a fantastic show. But so with the varieties that we're seeing, how are we now helping to reach out to the audiences that maybe never have seen anime yet?
All right, I'm going to take a crack at this. Like I said, with having anime available on basic cable, basically, I think is something that's very, very important. With movies like the Studio Ghibli films and the fact that they have the House of Mouse behind them now, I think has been a boon to anime as a genre, because having that marketing juggernaut behind it. But the thing is that then you have people that are able to go and to see this in the theater, and then they're able to say, you know what, that was really cool and it was really different. It doesn't look like anything else that I'm seeing on Nickelodeon or on Adult Swim or on whatever. I want to find out more about that. And you look up Studio Ghibli, and then the internet just vomits information. One of the things that I find is that there can be so much cognitive dissonance to people that are just discovering anime, because you put a room of anime fans together and say, what's the first show someone who has never seen anime should watch? And there will be fisticuffs. Everyone is so we are a very passionate people. We tend to be very invested into the shows that we love. Everyone is capable of being an anime fan. But I think more than anything else, it's trying to find people that are wanting to invest that kind of passion into it. For example, my favorite show, if somebody says, you know, I'm interested in getting into anime, the first thing I ask them is, what's your favorite movie? Mm-hmm. It's a great way to just get an idea of what somebody likes. And, you know, one of my favorite shows to show to people that's one of my favorite series is Trigun. I love to show people Trigun because it has a wonderful story, it has the action, it has the funny, and it has the feels. And so I think that's one of the things that I like to tell people about anime, and one of the reasons why I think that it's a genre that you can usually get people invested in is that it does, it covers all of those bases, usually within one show. Even when you're talking about a show that's intended to be pretty funny, there are still some very deep moments. I mean, even Italia has some wistful moments in it. So, it's being able to find out what somebody likes and then to be able to communicate that to them from an anime perspective. One show that I encourage everyone to watch, male or female, I don't care who you are, if you are interested in anime, do not pass go, do not collect $200, you go out and you buy Revolutionary Girl Utena. It is one of my absolute favorite series, and I really think that was also one that helped to change the genre, is because it was so stylistically unique. A lot of what we see now and what is considered an anime look, I feel like really came from Utena.
How do you explain the movie?
Drugs.
You don't explain the movie.
I see it as being a show that has themes within it. And I like to make a joke that I said, you know, Revolutionary Girl Utena could also be called Gender Confusion and Everyone Slaps Anthe. But that's one of the great things about the show, is that when you first start watching it, it's like she's supposed to marry this person, but she wants to be like this person, and it's just a really interesting way to process the information. Even to explore just gender themes within that. But you don't necessarily have to know that when you're 13 years old and you're watching the show. It's a beautiful show. So that's one of the reasons why I really encourage people to watch Utena. Another one that's really great to get into, especially if you're talking about a younger audience, is I'll pimp my own company, One Piece. One Piece is fantastic, and you know what? You'll be able to consume it forever because it's never gonna end. That's one of the great things about some of the anime series, is that you can invest yourself into them. You know, in the same way that people have invested, you know, Dallas in the 1980s, people invested themselves into the characters. And we do the same things with these shows. And especially one of the things that I love about One Piece is the camaraderie. Is the finding your own family. Finding what everybody's strengths are and how they make up for someone else's weakness and working together. And that is a theme that I think is so important within anime and a lot of the other series, is that you know, you band together to become bigger than what you are, and you fight for the underdog. And one of the other things that I like, in addition to the strong...
Even across genres, that's a constant theme. Mm-hmm. It's so important.
And one of the things that I really, that I also really like about anime is the underdog, you know, right, rising to the occasion, which is, you know, I mean, that's just a total archetypal character, but in a very different way. You know, the anime allows them to be really awkward, allows them to be really silly in a way, and in a way that is a little bit more friendly, I think, than you'll find in some other types of media.
Yeah, and it goes back to that. There's something for everyone, you know. People think, will I like anime? You will like. There's, if you look hard enough, or you don't even have to look that hard. There is something that you will like. What are you into? You into you into cutesy stuff? Sure, watch some Hello Kitty. Watch whatever if you want. But are you into like dark noir crime dramas? There's stuff. There's that too. You know, you like sci-fi. You like fantasy. There's that. You like real life. You like sports. There's all of it, and you know, you just got to know where to look. And there is absolutely something for everyone. The types of storytelling, the types of characters, just make anime so welcoming.
Yes.
So
I'm one of those 90s kids, but I love like collecting all the DVDs, and I have my collection. I brag on my friends, and I have quite a few Funimation titles. You mentioned that there's a lot of download to own stuff that's going to be coming out. Do you ever see the future of DVDs like physically having stuff going away?
Not within anime, because so many. It's such a huge part of the genre where we're collectors. You know, we buy the special editions as soon as it comes out. We've got all this stuff pre-ordered on Right Stuff. We've got, you know, it's just like we get the new Good Smile flyer at the con and go, I need everything. You know, we in the same way that we invest ourselves within the character, we invest ourselves within the property. And so, pardon?
All the extras.
Yes, yes. For example, my living room has an Evangelion theme, and I'm not ashamed to admit that. We don't want to just experience it from a media consumption point. We want to experience it within all the facets of our life.
That immersion.
Yeah, it's the complete immersion within it. And a big part of that comes from the fan culture that was established in Japan as well. So the otaku culture of really, you know, putting yourself into the show, into the lifestyle. And so I have a feeling that DVD and Blu-ray will never go away. And especially as... And so people, I feel, are still going to want the physical product. So, but I do see online streaming, download to own, and that kind of thing becoming a bigger and bigger part of companies like Funimation going forward, because there are a lot of people that, you know, they might want to just watch a couple episodes before they buy it. And that wasn't really, that wasn't really an option back in the early days of fandom, where I had mentioned earlier when we were chatting upstairs that, you know, I went to cons for the video rooms because that was the only way that I could see new stuff without having to buy it. And that was, by golly, that was an investment, because it was, I mean, a lot of people complain about anime prices. I'm having another you kids get off my lawn moment. And so a lot of people, we've had a lot of people complain about, you know, sometimes the price points of some of the products that have been put out and that kind of thing. But it's because there's an immense amount of work that goes into this. So, you know, you're not dealing with something where you've got, where you're talking about completely original content, where we're having to go back in, we're having to do what's called matching the flaps, so that once again, so that you get a more realistic and authentic experience while you're watching the shows, as opposed to, you know, the Japanese dubs they used to make fun of, where the person's mouth moves for like 5 seconds and then they say yes. So by changing things up that way and putting out better quality product like that, that's one of the reasons why I don't think that it'll ever go away. On top of the fact that a lot of anime fans are like me, where they want to go back and they want to revisit the shows again and again. Those characters become your friends. And you're having a bad day, and you know, if I'm having a crappy day, I go home and watch Summer Wars. because I just feel better after I do. With the level of, and once again, it's that level of investment that we have in the shows that we love that's kind of unique, that you don't really see a lot of in other shows.
And again, it's because that fan, the collector mentality and fandom, no matter what it is, are so intrinsically, united that for me, as a comic book fan too, sure, I buy lots of comics on my iPad, but I still have to go to the shop every Wednesday and get my floppies, because I need that. It is that community that you look what I have, therefore I am part of this.
Well, and that's also, both Chris and I come from a little bit of a unique perspective, because I think it's like a lot of you guys, we are equal opportunity nerdists. We have a lot of different interests, and anime is a huge part of my life, but I love Star Wars, I love Doctor Who, I've loved Doctor Who since I was tiny, I like Monty Python, I like comic books, I like science fiction, one of the first memories that I have is curling up with my dad in his Barca lounger and watching Star Trek together. I think that, and a lot of people like us, we're looking for something that's different. And I think that's one of the reasons why anime appeals to us, is because it's the level of storytelling. There's more depth to it than you find in other things. There's more, the fantastical nature of it is one of the things that I love. And especially in a lot of my favorite shows, there is that huge, that how everything is, not necessarily everything, but how a lot of things, it's amplified so that you invest in those characters, so that you have that, that visceral gut reaction to things sometimes. For example, in Summer Wars, when Granny dies, I cry every time. I've seen that movie 100 times.
Thanks for the support.
So. You haven't seen Summer Wars, right. You're fired.
Why would I watch it? I didn't get to be in it. Kidding.
Bitter, party of one, your table is ready.
I go to King of Thorn instead. Sorry.
Talking about being Doctor Who fans and that, and I was thinking about niche markets and fandoms currently. The one difference that I've always seen with anime fandoms is that we're more willing to let people in and take it at their own pace. Like if you want to just watch one show and be a fan of that show, awesome, we love you. As opposed to, I'm thinking of groups like, even Homestuck or Doctor Who.
I wish they would calm down just a little, though. The Homestuckers, anyway.
It's a different sort of fandom, because those are very closed markets, and if you don't get it, you're not a part of the community as much as you can be in an anime fandom, where they don't care what you love as long as you love it. And that's probably another part. I'm thinking of the answer of the question that we're all here to answer. I think the popularity stems from the inviting, letting you into the niche, and opening it up. My question, though, is on a completely different topic.
I do want to get back to that after the question.
Yes, so. I was thinking about, maybe it's kind of involved in that, fandom and how they create their own content to further the groups. How do you feel about groups like Team Four Star and how they continue to propagate like group things that haven't really had much new, or if it's new, they're building on that, like Dragon Ball Z and getting involved in the community and doing their own dubbing and doing their own cartoons and things. What part does that play in the role of getting anime popular with other people?
Well, it's once again one of the things that I have noticed a lot about anime fans as well, is that they want to feel like they're a part of the shows that they love. And that's one of the reasons why, you have like what is it, Anime Abridged, the Dragon Ball Z, the Dragon Ball Abridged and all that kind of stuff, is that they're taking something they have a deep and intense respect for, but they're putting their own spin on it. And though I can't necessarily as an industry professional condone some of the things that happen, I appreciate them. And I love the fact that parody is can be the most sincerest form of flattery. And so I feel like that by doing things like that, and AMVs, for example, there's hours and hours and days of work that go into things like that. But they're doing it because they have that investment into it, and because they want to be able... I think AMVs are a great way to introduce people to anime, because you can pick a song that you like, and there is an AMV for it. And it's just depending upon what show it is. Like, for example... Florence and the Machine, one of my favorite bands. There is a Florence and the Machine Modica Magica AMV out there that will break your fracking heart. It is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my entire life. And I think that AMVs are a vital and important part of the fandom. And I think that the parodies and that kind of thing are very, very important to the fandom. That is a little bit more unique to the United States as well. Things like that, especially from what I have been told, things like that in Japan can sometimes be seen as very disrespectful to the original content and the original creator. So it's one of those things that, well, we can't completely poo-poo it, we can't completely support it either. But we understand that is something that's very important and vital.
It's like the flip of doujinshi. It's our version of that, I guess.
Exactly. So, but going back to what you had said, speaking of the anime community being inclusive, if you're a group and you want to come hang out with us, cool. You know, I mean, it's just like, we brought, you know, the furries came, fine. The steampunkers came, cool. The video game folks came, awesome. You know what, if you like video, you like Mass Effect, why don't you watch Appleseed? You know, that kind of thing. And bringing, it's like, we'll take what you like, and we'll give you something that you're going to dig from us. And we're all going to love each other, just don't be a jerk, is my So, you know, I mean, you see as much non-anime cosplay at anime conventions now as you see anime cosplay, for the most part. Because we have given them a safe and loving environment in which to express themselves. So, and a lot of those people are anime fans, but you know what? Maybe you just want to dress like Fiona from Adventure Time. Or, you know, maybe Marceline speaks to you in a way that is impactful upon your life right now. So, you know what? You walk around with a guitar shaped like an axe. So, I think that's one of the other reasons why anime has continued to grow, is because we bring people into our fold, you know, and come to the dark side, we've got cookies. So, you know, we're gonna love you until you give us a reason not to. And that's I think, is one of the most important attitudes that you find within, especially, the convention setting. Yes?
Kind of speaking to, you brought up Uzuna before, and it kind of hurtling with me anyway. One of the things I've seen, and maybe it's just being a little older, but I've seen that a lot of times things will bleed across demographics. Say, oh no, that's targeted like adult women. But you know, I've seen guys who will eat that stuff up and still watch all the show notes. And I guess what I wonder is, can you market that?
We can, it's sometimes in a very subtle way. Just to throw this out there real quick, because I absolutely adore this. It's a YouTube channel that's done by PBS. It's called The Idea Channel. And they did an absolutely fantastic video about how bronies are changing the definition of masculinity. And so I've got a smart crowd. And I think that is something that is, for the most part, especially amongst the hardcore anime fans, i.e. most of you here today, is the fact that it's okay to like what you like. You know, I know guys that can recite Sengoku Basara word for word, but cry when they watch Fruits Basket. So, it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. We recently had a streaming title on called Kami-sama Kiss that was unbelievable. unbelievably popular, and I like to call it a new generation's Fruits Basket. It's been the most watched streaming title we've ever had. But one of the things that shocked us was how unbelievably popular it was with the dudes. We weren't expecting that. That's one of the reasons why we at Funimation especially have kind of adopted an attitude of equal opportunity marketing. Because we know that a lot of these shows can appeal to very different people on very different levels. So that's why, you know, I mean, we might have a tagline or something like that for a show, because you need to have that little snippet for something. Like, for example, probably I think the best one that came out last year. Does anybody care if I swear?
No.
No? Okay.
That's fine.
Panty and stocking. Drop those britches, bitches. Is there a better way to sum up that show? There seriously isn't. So without the copyright violation of Powerpuff Girls Gone Wild. So, it's, you know, I mean, it's... So there's, you know, I mean, I that's one of the reasons why we like I said, we're equal opportunity marketers in that respect, because we have just kind of been like, really, those people are buying that? On a couple of occasions, so we're just like, you know what? It's a good show. Check it out. So.
And I appreciate that, because I tend to gravitate, the shows that I'm really excited about getting to work on as a director are the shows that are the hardest to market. The things like Princess Jellyfish, or Beck, Mongolian Chop Squad, or Speed Grapher. You know, these shows that are so unique and are so, you know, of their own, you know, that thing that, yeah, who do you market them to? Because it's not like anything else that's come before it, you know. But there's still so much value to them that, you know, it's like, yeah, how do you market something that everybody needs to watch just because? You can't just put that. You can't put that on an ad. Watch it just because. Thank you.
Sorry, it just keeps going wonky. But yeah, so that's one of the things too about, especially some of the really compelling content that we've got coming out. Like, you know, I mean, for example, Hitalia. Who'd have thunk it? I mean, seriously, it's charmingly racist brain candy. But it's you know, we never expected the kind of reaction from Hitalia that we...
I didn't do it.
You used the phone.
So that's... and because at Funimation we've released such a wide breadth of type... Maybe it will stop. I think it just doesn't like that. I moved my phone because I thought that might be part of it. But here.
There we go.
I'm a microphone stand now. But yes, so anyway, that totally derailed my train of thought, so I apologize. So does anybody else have any questions? Yes.
Before I get to my question, I want to thank you, sir, for voicing Hanamori in Princess Jellyfish.
Thank you.
Wonderful rendition.
Thank you.
But getting back to the whole demographics idea aspect, one of the things with Princess Jellyfish that we saw was we got to actually see female fans, like not necessarily anime fans, but like fans of other stuff like trains and Japanese clothing and the whole aspect with otaku, meaning it could be an uber fan of anything.
Yeah, those actually were, Helsing Ultimate was one of our most popular titles last year. And Princess Jellyfish, especially amongst the Funimation crew, Princess Jellyfish was probably the number one most loved anime produced by Funimation by the Funimation employees last year. Yeah. So we all adored Princess Jellyfish. You are starting to see that more and more, and especially like with cosplay gatherings and that kind of thing, and the number of fan panels that are being produced for specific shows now. I do fan panels at cons where it's, once again, I take off my Funimation shirt, and then it's just like, and I'm here to nerd out with you about Fairy Tale. I think that again is an important and vital part of the fandom is by having those people that are so enthusiastic, and those are the people that also help us to spread the word about shows. It's one of the things that's really important to the health of companies, of anime companies in the United States, is your enthusiasm. Your enthusiasm is unbelievably important. If we did not have the kind of fandom that we do, anime probably wouldn't have been as successful within the United States, because you guys latch onto it and run with it. And just like you were saying with fanfic and that kind of thing, once again with the availability of new media and that kind of and things, that it's easier to get it out there than it used to be before, as opposed to sitting around in a circle at Funimation or at a convention and just being like, well, hey, what if this happened with this person? What if these two characters from these two shows got together and they went on adventures and blah, blah, blah? Well, now you can type that up and put it on a Tumblr. So, which I think is fantastic. And, you know, somebody might be like, so they're into Sherlock. They read Sherlock, and for some reason, Goku pops up in there. What if they don't know who Goku is? They go and they type it in, and they go, oh, that seems kind of cool. And then all of a sudden, they're watching Dragon Ball. So it's situations like that where it gives people, once again, that might not necessarily have been exposed to it, an opportunity to see what it's all about. So... and I think that we were told that we're about to get the hook. So. But thank you guys so much. Thank you for coming out. Thank you for braving the weather. At least for us in Texas, this is weather to be brave. So, I'm so honored and privileged to have been included in this by the Rocky Mountain Anime Association and also by the Consulate General. And I'm so thrilled to be here.
What she said.
All right. We gotta watch out for that cable, because that cable was part of our problem. Thank you.
Welcome back. I am your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, and guess what we're going to do today? I'm going to go ahead and do a review of Monsters University, the latest from Pixar, and the latest, well, their last one was Brave, their next one up is The Good Dinosaur, I think? Yeah. Anywho, let's talk about Monsters University, but before we start on Monsters University, let me take a brief moment brief in my words, to talk about the trailers in front of the movie and the short film, The Blue Umbrella. The trailers in front of the film were, well, there's one for the abysmal Smurfs 2, which is a good audience reaction, but I am not in the audience for that film. To be fair, I never watched the first film, and I admit that movies like Stuart Little and Alvin and Chipmunks got better after viewing them a few times. Will I give Smurfs 2 a chance in theaters? No. Will I watch it someday on Netflix? Probably. I like Neil Patrick Harris. The trailer for Despicable Me 2 reaffirms my hopes for that movie, and the audience reaction to the Minions bodes well for Illumitoon. The trailer for Planes told me that I'm probably going to find it to be an amusing movie. I honestly enjoyed the original Cars because it had some depth to it. While Cars 2 gets some flack, I'll come out and say that Cars 2 was much more fun than Quantum Solace. I'm sorry, the best Bond spy action film that year had a tow truck as the main character. If you take it as what it is, a parody similar to the No One Lives Forever video game series, then it's obvious. Yeah, there are a lot of stereotypes in the Cars universe. Planes expands on that a few degrees as well. I mean, there's a Lugador plane. I'm okay with this. I don't expect it to be a masterpiece. I just expect it to be mildly funny and look good. Now, the trailer for Frozen revealed nothing about it. Instead, the worrisome, possibly annoying snowman character and the caribou were the main characters in a teaser trailer that feels more like those scratch shorts for Ice Age than a major Disney musical, which is what Frozen is. It's a musical. A major Disney musical with a Disney princess in it. But, hey, look at our snowman chasing after his nose. Yeah. Anyhow, I am cautiously optimistic on that one, and audience response was good. Now, there was a trailer for Turbo. Now, The Croods was really good, but had awful trailers. Epic was gorgeous, terrible trailers, but Epic deserves to have a ton of fans. I mean, if you liked Rise of the Guardians, go see Epic. It's good, and you'll probably like it as much or even more than Rise of the Guardians. Epic is a bit of an unsung movie. Some odd character designs plague both Epic and The Croods, but both are really good. Trust me on this, they're good. Now, Turbo doesn't look too good to me. We have awkward humans a la Rio and Ryan Reynolds trying to channel Owen Wilson from Cars. That said, the director and the screenplay writers are known mostly for The Wrestler. And, well, this could be funny or it could be awful. I don't know. I mean, if it's a bit of a parody of things like, I don't know, Drive, The Fast and the Furious, or Speed Racer, I might be okay with it. I do have to say that I am a bit concerned that there's already a Netflix exclusive show based on this film set to debut in December. The kids in the audience appear to like it. I'm just, like the Smurfs too, I am not the target audience. I can't wait for this to hit Netflix though, because that is probably where I will watch it. Now, The Blue Umbrella, the short film in front of Monsters University, is really pretty. I mean, the concept of it makes me think of another short film called Giant Fedora and Alice Blue Bonnet from the Disney package film Make Mine Music. The concept is cute, and the use of realistically rendered objects is endearing. There is, however, a bit of peril in the film that younger kids might be uncomfortable with. There were some audible gasps of shock in the theater. I know this because I was pretty stunned myself. Unlike Paper Man, which is cute without peril, The Blue Umbrella is fairly dark. No kids crying in the theater, but I don't think many of them quite grasped what happened in the short film. With Paper Man, I felt that it would be worth the price of admission. I felt Paper Man was worth the price of the admission alone, and luckily for me, it was attached to Wreck-It Ralph, which was really good. And I think The Blue Umbrella is a film that you need to see if you appreciate the independent spirit of animation. I mean, if you need to see this, it kind of reminds me a bit of One Rat Short or The Eternal Gaze or Bunny. It was really good. It was gorgeous too. I mean, it looked almost live action, but it's not. I was really impressed with it. It reminded me of like One Rat Short, Bunny, or The Eternal Gaze, all of which are masterpieces of CGI animation. And you cannot call yourself a, animation student or a lover of animation if you haven't seen One Rat Short or The Eternal Gaze or Bunny. Look those up on YouTube. They're worth checking out. The Eternal Gaze is essential. I think people need to see it. It is right up there with some of the stuff. Oh, what is the name of that group of brothers? They did I'll remember their name after this is over with, but yeah, it's worth seeing. The Blue Umbrella is really great, and it was a great way to settle down the theater, I guess is the best way to put it, before the main attraction. Now, the main attraction was Monsters University. How was Monsters University? Well, there are three types of films that critics hate. Reboots, sequels, and prequels. As a critic, I love original work, but I also see merit in those three kinds of films. Out of the three, a prequel is the hardest to do successfully. Monsters Incorporated is a fine film with a clever concept. The first film's concept is that the monsters under your bed or in your closet are just as scared of you as you are of them. They just need you to be scared because your fear powers their homes, cars, cities, and everyday life. Without you being afraid, they can't operate. They can't live. The plot of the first movie is that a child accidentally gets into the monster world, and the two main characters, James B. Sullivan and Mike Wazowski, have to return the child to her family. The problem with the prequel is that the concept of the first film is a bit slim. So how do you do a prequel to Monsters Incorporated? Well, first thing you do is find a few questions from the first film that may be left unanswered, and then find a good central place to start the story that could effectively answer those questions. Now, the first film is more about James P. Sullivan and Boo. You're given more insight into Sully than you are for Mike, Randall, and the other characters in the movie. Mike is just a sidekick character in the first film. He's comedic relief. There's no real reason for the two characters to be friends. I mean, Sully and Mike are kind of an odd couple looking thing. There's no reason for them to be friends. None. There are also some very nagging questions that Monsters Incorporated doesn't answer for the sake of a speedy narrative. Some of the questions that Monsters University answers, though, are as follows. 1. Why are James and Mike friends? You need to watch this film to understand that, and I think it's put through beautifully here. 2. What is the general structure of the monster world? In the first film, I had a real problem with, The first film makes it appear like there's only one monopolistic power company called Monsters Incorporated, where everyone gets their scare energy from. This is kind of revealed, just kind of a side note. There are actually several. Monsters Incorporated is just the largest. 3. Why does Randall hate Sullivan so much? Well, this one actually requires watching Monsters University and then thinking a little bit more about Randall's situation. They really made his character much more fleshed out. In Monsters Incorporated, he's a bit of a stooge. He's just kind of there. He's mean with no real purpose for being mean. Just nasty with no real purpose for it. He doesn't have a motivation. He doesn't. But going through Monsters University, you understand his motivation in Monsters Incorporated a bit more, and you understand that it's actually kind of tragic. 4. Who had the original all-time scare record? Yeah. 5. Where are the doors made? 6. When did James and Mike actually meet? 7. How does the flow of time actually work in between the two worlds, the monster world and the human world? Actually, they kind of answer that one offhand in Monsters Incorporated, and it's interesting to know. Because, with Monsters, Inc., there is certain stuff you just kind of had to accept. And here in Monsters University, if you're paying attention, and this is why I can't wait for it to come out on Blu-ray, because I'll pause at spots and read, because they kind of answer that. They really give a fairly definitive answer to that. But I'm not going to tell how. I'm not going to tell you how, because spoilers. Anyways, there's a bunch of little stuff, too, that gets answered. Monsters University adds new layers of paint to the simplistic story of the first film. I would say that the addition of Monsters University makes some parts of Monsters Incorporated, which were just silly or even tedious, stand out as relevant or significant in a greater story arc. The best thing that a prequel can do is to make the original film better. We think about it. Episodes 1, 2, and 3 hurt episodes 4, 5, and 6, and that was the most grievous sin. The most general grievous sin that they committed. If you make a prequel and you make a bad prequel, you're going to hurt the rest of your franchise. And this is not a bad prequel. No. This makes the original film better. Monsters University makes me like the characters more because it exists. Also, this movie's gorgeous. I've already said that before about the Blue Umbrella, but wow. This is a really pretty movie. The jokes are pretty funny. Some of the awkward humor works well in the context of the film. "I can't go back to jail" is going to get more laughs out of adults than it will children. The nice twists and turns the plot takes are excellent. The film takes what I liked about the Harry Potter movies and adds it to the monster's world in a very effective way. What I love about Harry Potter is Hogwarts. The idea of a school of wizarding and magic is awesome. The idea of a school where monsters study how to scare children is pretty great. And the way it is presented is superb. The film has interesting enough twists and turns and moments to it to make an excellent use of your theater time. I saw it in 2D, so I have no comments on how the 3D was used in the film. Looking at my notes, I think you should go see Monsters University. I personally prefer it to Monsters Incorporated. I found that it made the first film stronger. There were a lot of great moments, and honestly, there are some spots in the human world that just blew me away at how fantastic they look. I really went away from the film liking the characters much more than I did with Monsters Incorporated, especially Mike. Mike in the first film is just kind of there and kind of an idiot. In this film, we get to see him more competent, more stressed, much more bold. He's much, 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 much more likable this time around. Also, the film is still about fear. The first film used fear as a plot device to push an overt message about alternative energy, which was coupled with a two monsters and a toddler style plot. This film uses fear as a driving force of character interactions. We have a fear of rejection, failure, being forgotten, being unseen. We have genuine terror at possibly life-threatening circumstances. We have a fear of the future. In a way, the main characters learn to overcome their fears so that they can become better instruments for using fear. Then they discover a way around that fear for a brighter future in Monsters, Inc. There is nothing in this film that can be construed as political in any way. Also, the characters mature in this film in a way that is satisfying. None of the characters are dead weight, and the film never feels too long. Now, kids tend to chatter in movies, and this did detract from a few scenes in the film. I honestly can't wait to get this film on 3D Blu-ray because I want to see the 3D effect on my own home without kids roaring along with the characters or asking questions during dramatic sequences. So yeah, I would give Monsters University an A. I recommend seeing it in theaters a half dozen times. I'm your host, Philip Wesley. This has been the Animation is Art Audio Experience, part of Radio DMG, and good night. It for this episode of Radio DMG. I am your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, and well, let's see. If you're watching these, sorry, we're not watching these. If you're accessing these from the website, you can download the first episode of the Animation is Our Audio Experience in the comment area, the little introduction area, and then the second episode, which is pretty much what you listen to. Except with, like, you know, there's some extra extremities attached to it. Yeah. Download our stuff. You can do it. Go there, you'll be able to download the musical rations by themselves and the audio reviews for Animation is Art, the audio experience, by themselves. Neat, huh? Neat. So, anyways, yeah, if you don't already, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, go to our store and spend lots of money. That would be Animation is Art. Yeah. So, yeah. If you like this, tell your friends. I think we're still on iTunes, so I guess you can subscribe to us there. But yeah. Love us. Like us. Become our Facebook buddies. Or more than buddies. Actually, I'm going to stop. This doesn't need to sound creepy. Anyways, that's it for today. See you next time on Radio DMG. I'm your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, and good night. say classy Denver. No, actually, to be honest, I don't know what we're going to do with that. We should have some type of outro. Let me think of one. Good night, and no, I'm not going to do that. That's kind of meh. And that's the rest of the story. Yeah. Maybe I'll just keep saying just good night, because I don't know. Good night. That makes sense. It actually makes sense to say that. So, I guess my ending catchphrase will be good night. I can't patent that. What's it matter? Horse crackers.